we've been under a political and ideological Marxist assault now for nearly a century. It began in the 1930s. It's a KGB operation. And we're now at a real tipping point. But there is a spiritual dimension to this war as well. There's something much bigger going on here than just Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, right? Or Donald Trump versus Ron DeSantis. This is happening on a much higher spiritual plane. And it is God versus the enemy. It's good versus evil. And I'm so grateful for all of you, what you do every single day on this network and on this show, calling people's attention to the real nature of the enemy here.
Well, thank you, Monica Fowler. Left Reckoning 123. 123 with me, as always, David Griffin.
Hey, brother, you ready for some spiritual warfare?
I guess, honestly, I may be a little bit tired of spiritual warfare, but let's get it. I mean, that's Monica Crowley, of course, there. Folks might remember her as Steve Mnuchin's press secretary under the Trump administration. She's a New York Post columnist in the 90s, a Fox News personality. She's also she got her start in politics by writing to President Nixon as a fan, and Nixon hired her as a researcher for several books that he wrote. So she's gone crazier than that, I think, since then, I guess, to be glib about her situation. I'd just say she's thanking, actually, Flashing Point, which is a part of the Victory channel, and just to read off who they are, because I'm not really caught up with all the different right-wing sort of splinter channels these days, but this channel is...
It is awesome that the right wing is sort of going through its own, like, Trotskyist moment, right? Just splitting into smaller and smaller factions.
Some people more sort of, like, racist, some more, like, just a Christian dominionist. In 2015, God brought a new idea to Kenneth Copeland Ministries to build a faith-based Christian television network unlike any other. Now, does Kenneth Copeland ring a bell for you, David?
He's that funny-looking guy, right?
Yeah, he's this guy.
Isn't it true that you want to fly commercial so that you can fly in luxury? How much money did you pay for Tyler Perry's Gulfstream jet, for example?
Well, for example, that's really none of your business, but...
Isn't it the business of your donors?
Listen, I paid. The airplane that we have that I bought from Tyler Perry, and I didn't pay anywhere. Tyler's one of the greatest guys. He made that airplane so cheap for me, I couldn't help but buy it. I love your eyes.
Again, getting back to the comment, you said that you don't like to fly commercial because you don't want to get into a tube with a bunch of demons. Do you really believe that human beings are demons?
No, I do not. And don't you ever say I did. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but principalities and power.
Exactly. So look, David, let's wrestle with principalities and powers. Now, you want to take us to a higher place, unless you want to comment more on Copeland there.
That's good. I think we should start talking like that.
Exactly. Cormac McCarthy passed, and, I saw some people saying, like, maybe we're being a little bit too... gushing about how we remember Cormac McCarthy. Nobody's really sticking their aura in to be negative against Cormac. But I'll just say, like, that sort of meditative, like you're chanting, like you're channeling something speech that is very religiously sort of like inflected. Like Faulkner was very good at that too. Obviously Moby Dick is the goat, Herman Melville, the goat at that. But yeah, I do think we should channel more of that and get out of like this sort of like gamer TikTok speech of like, oh, hey guys, this just happened and we're doing this. Now we need to all speak like guys who have seen 1,000 years flash before us.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, man, I've also been watching Righteous Gemstones, obviously, since it's come out, and I've been feeling the spirit in me again. Been taking myself back to church a little bit. And we have a great show for everyone tonight, but to be honest, it's a tough one. I mean, two difficult stories, right? One from here in Texas, which we'll get into in a little bit, and another one from Wisconsin, which are, two major defeats for everyday people. But I think before we get there, I want to take a little bit of time, you know, not to borrow too much from the illustrious preacher before us, but I want to talk a little bit about sustaining ourselves, both like politically and individually, to be able to recognize what's wrong with like the world and with our movements, but also not lose that kind of radical optimism that we have to change it. Because, you know, as we talk about a lot on this program, I mean, this program has been born out of a lot of really difficult times, you know, both politically and personally for Matt and I. And there's no doubt about it right now that things are tough for the workers' movement in the U.S. After two shots with Bernie ending in defeat, there are many questions as to where we go next. And I think it's really critical to be able to take the long view and recognize that, one, we are much stronger than we were so much. And if you came into this, the workers and socialist movement through Bernie, you may miss just how dark and ineffective and callous the old U.S. Left landscape was. But, you know, just because we're better than we were doesn't mean that it's time to relax, because clearly it's not. And because so much of this movement came from those particular origins, politically around the Bernie movement, socially at a time of mass atomization and demobilization in society, while we have been growing and building our power, we've also developed some pretty bad habits. And, you know, we talked when Biden decided to run again, and we realized we could potentially be going through a replay of 2020, Trump versus Biden, about these kind of morbid symptoms that come from some of the structuralistness, both in American society and also on the left. Before on the show, you can go watch that video, Morbid Symptoms. But I wanted to focus on something else that's not so much just strategic confusion, but a bit about a kind of psychology on the left that I think we need to break out of. It's an idea that I've kicked the tires on a few times, both here and back in the day on TMBS, this concept of left pessimism, which is something that's very distinct from hopelessness, though it oftentimes comes out of hopelessness. It's this tendency to become bitter about conditions so much that your frustrations turn away from like the capitalist class and the political class to everyday people and to workers, right? You lose your kind of radical belief in people, in the possibility of socialism, and fall into this kind of nihilism, you know, could be summed up in a way by like the world is fucked up, but people are too stupid or lazy to do anything about it, right? And instead of trying to change politics, trying to change society, you're just doing moral witness, right? I see that things are messed up. I see that things are wrong. You know, and it's a hyper-moralist position, always looking to cut out, to label those around you as false, as grifters, bigots, etc., with none of the patience and grace that is going to be necessary to sustain a long-viewed movement. It's death wish politics, and it's a poison to the left. And I get that it can be hard, right? The planet is cooking. People are dying needless deaths because of our for-profit healthcare system, and workers the world over are toiling in service for the profit of the few. But we can't allow the current conditions to deny us our future, and even more critically in the present moment, to be able to think about the future. Mark Fisher, you know, the way that he describes depression in his classic book, Capitalist Realism, something that I always sort of go back to at times like this, he describes depression as the feeling that nothing good will happen again. And on second analysis, nothing good has really ever happened before, right? And this pitfall is something that we must be able to avoid as we embark on the difficult work of critique of ourselves and of the movements that we're a part of. Be able to see what works and what didn't, what worked then that may not be able to work again, and so on. And we have to be able to do this without falling into this kind of political depression, slide backwards into political immobility. There's this quote by Antonio Gramsci, the famous Marxist, that everyone quotes, and it's a great one because it's, you know, it's worthwhile to get into. But I think it's really critical to note that like the first part of this quote is almost always left off. And I think it's really important to read the whole thing in full. And this is this Antonio Gramsci quote: "The challenge of modernity is to live without illusions, without becoming disillusioned. I'm a pessimist because of intelligence, but an optimist because of will." And this is someone who saw revolution and also the rise of fascism, somebody who spent years imprisoned, but was also able to leave a mark on the globe and the workers' movement. And I think being able to have that long-viewed look at politics and our own role in it is really important. We have to be able to slot ourselves in history, right? There's going to be huge victories, and there's also going to be really massive defeats. we're engaged in a class struggle right now, and it's also one that has preceded us. And like, why am I saying this? Like, you know, what is this about? Because I think right now, the thing that keeps me up at night, the thing that really worries me, is I think we are at a critical moment, not just politically, you know, all the things that are happening to people, but like a critical moment in the left, in our generation, in this fight. We're at a critical moment because I can see things going many, many different ways. And a lot of them are worse than where we are right now. We could go in the direction of there being countless fractures on the left to the point of irrelevance. There's a threat of this left democratic socialist movement being absorbed into the larger left or progressive formation. There's a big threat of depoliticization coming purely out of exhaustion and frustration and this retreat to nostalgia, right? And like, you know, talk to folks, you hear this all the time with people who might not be political, older people, they'll say things like, oh, when I was younger, I was a radical, right? And this is a countless cycle of American history and also human history, right? That you have these young generations, these movements that fight for change, they don't succeed, and then they sort of retreat into themselves and into nostalgia. And I think we have to deny all of those. I think that what we have to do is take this radical position of optimism, an optimism rooted in material reality, that this fight can this fight cannot be won via will alone, but is going to require the construction of a working class movement, not just something that like we allude to as an idea. And I think this is another thing that we fall into this trap saying, like, oh, we need the workers' movement. Like, what do we mean by that? I mean by that like an organization of really existing power of the working class, both on the level of politics, maybe organized in a party or a political movement, and at the workplace. And to be able to build that, that's not something that you can just sort of will and hope for. That's going to take real work and commitment. So this question of like depression or lack of a future or like the retreat from utopian thinking, right? And by utopia too, just for the theory nerds out there, I'm not talking about, you know, escapism or fantasy. I'm talking just generally in the layman's usage of that term, like the idea that there is a better world is possible, right? It's one of the old slogans of the left. You know, to be able to construct this, we're going to need to have something that can sustain ourselves as we build and gain strength. We have to be able to reclaim thinking big, to have these utopian horizons and be committed to them. And too often on the left right now, I find that we fall into defensive struggles. And of course, we have to be, right? All of our rights are under threat. These things are really dangerous and we should be fighting against them. I'm not saying we need to change strategy per se. But we can't do that to the exclusion of that more forward-thinking movement, right? Where we're not solely fighting to make sure that things don't get worse. We are actually actively fighting for things to get better. In the short term, you know, we want things like public power, universal education, not just a living wage, but a thriving one, universal healthcare, an end to war, democracy, not just at the ballot box, but at work. And in the long term, we need to be able to fight to build a system that commodifies to abolish a system that commodifies everything, even ourselves and society. And to be able to do that, you know, we have to be able to take our victories and be able to celebrate them and use those to sustain ourselves. We have to be patient with each other and with our movements. And we also have to learn how to be able to critique and learn lessons without falling into nihilism or depression or demobilization. And I have a Panitch section that I wanted to play in a minute that I think sort of embodies this in a lot of ways, but you know, I wanted to open up the floor to you, Matt, on this, because I make this point a lot, right? That like I do think that there has been a decline in like utopian thinking on the left just in the past 4 years, and the things that people are demanding or talking about, and I think that that's something that is worrying.
Yeah, I'm curious what Panitch has to say. I mean, I do think there's been a definite degeneration in terms of like from the high point of Bernie. and I think like that's a big part of it, unfortunately. Like even things like from like DSA's drop in membership. It's like the sad thing is like clearly like people were energized by that mm-hmm. campaign especially. And you know, I redid, again, a DSA member, but like, it's tough because, you know, we also have a little bit of a jadedness about what these campaigns can do. And like, yeah, I mean, now it's, I mean, we're going to have a whole segment about Wisconsin, which basically just call our demoralizing voter turnout segment, because it's getting, and like the current candidates, you know, with all respect to Marianne, like the economics thing isn't punching through, and we just don't seem to be having a good conversation about politics anymore. And like, I don't know, like, what are we doing? Come together? Like, I don't know what we're talking about. And it is depressing. And I think it's too focused on elections. Things are crazy with elections. And part of it is where it's a post-Citizens United reality of there's just massive money funneled toward that specific question. And it gets outlitted in all sorts of different ways and through various degrees of like directness. But it's really perverted our thinking about like what we should even be thinking about this stuff
for. Yeah, I mean, I think that like the overfixation in the U.S. left on presidential campaigns, I think, is to our detriment, which is, again, like, this is where, you know, what I was saying, it's like being able to learn, like, these things work. Like, the Bernie campaign brought so many people, mobilized so many people, right? So it's understandable why there's this fixation on it. But, you know, learning that, like, attaching all of your hopes that maybe you can get some kind of world historic opening, you know, and just be sort of lucky, you know, I think only leads to more and more demobilization, because what people hate hearing this so much. But, you know, this is something that like Marx even talked about, right? When he split the original communist movement and the Communist League, one of the things that he was splitting with was that there were people within that communist movement who were saying, if there's not a revolution tomorrow, we might as well go to sleep. Right. And Marx left specifically saying that this is a project that will take 10, 15, 20 years. It doesn't mean that you won't get victories. It doesn't mean that things, you know, won't change. It doesn't mean that you just have to sort of patiently wait. In fact, it's the opposite. It's actually like a commitment to being able to be long viewed in the struggle. So like when it comes to these presidential campaigns, the question that you have to be asking yourself is this going to be something that moves the class struggle forward, that moves class organization forward, that moves political education forward? And if it isn't, you can support these things personally, right? But, you know, it's just not where our focus and energy needs to be. And like, you know, we have all these bad habits that I think we've inherited from this. And, you know, you're seeing it with all of these bizarre, you know, ideologies, you know, like the degrowth stuff, or even just like this kind of hyper online, like third world this thing. People who 4 years ago were like standing in unity with Bernie and saying that like, yeah, I think it's unfair that American workers, you know, are being ground down by capitalism and we want to end it along with imperialism and these wars. And now I've sort of turned it. So it's like, actually, my neighbors are all pigs. And I hope that their lives get worse, right? Because it'll get some level of moral victory, right? That's the height of that kind of left pessimism that I was talking about a minute ago.
Yeah, the misanthropy of like the problem is people didn't vote the way you wanted to, right? And it's just like, to me, it's like, if you don't trust people and like you locate the problem in people, I don't know why you're here unless it is to subjugate them, right? Like, I don't know why you pay attention to politics. If I genuinely didn't believe in the average person's like ability to govern themselves and have more a say over like, oh, how much time do they have to give to a fucking boss every week, right? If I didn't trust people to do that, if I thought they needed to be constrained like this, I would not be here. I would be, you know, playing video games all day and just, you know, watching the W's come in because this shit rocks for me. Like, yeah, I don't quite understand I said something the other day, like on Majority Report, that like you can't be misanthropic and on the left. And like, that's just shocking to people because I think so many people, like our culture just like accepts people saying things like, oh yeah, everyone's a moron, or, and that stuff actually is political. It's political that you're saying.
So let's play this little clip from Leo Panitch. This is from an interview with Micah Utrecht at Jacobin. You know, if people want it, they can, I'll tweet it out later. But listen to this. And like, this is very specifically on one thing that I want to like maybe use to inspire people. Cause this is post, you know, this is towards the end of these Bernie campaigns and these moments, right? And what he's talking about here is how these doors have been open and how we have to sustain and continue to build. Most importantly, as like Americans, not just for yourself, but also for the globe, recognizing that like the left movement is a global one, and like the ability of like Americans, for example, to fundamentally change like the American state and American politics has knockdown effects for the rest of the globe. In fact, they are quite critical. As you know, if you read any history of left socialist movements around the globe, I mean, we had Amina on last week on the Grisham stream to talk about Cuba. Think about what they've had to go through because of the American empire, right? And if you care about those people, you should also care about building a strong, powerful left in this country that could be aiding instead of harming those movements, right? And I think like in taking some of that inspiration as to like, okay, we can actually build something and do something about this is what I was really hoping to try to reinvigorate in all of us, because it's sorely lacking right now. But here's Leo.
That said, what has happened with the Sanders insurrection, the growth of the DSA, the type of union activity we've been discussing in Chicago and LA, etc., proves to me that the American left is capable of blowing past the kind of reformist stuff that they look to in Canada and be so impressed by. Maybe you haven't been constrained by social democracy to the extent that we have, holding on to this little foothold electorally in this third party that we have in Canada, or you know, even the major parties in Europe. And if that happens, if you continue to build on what has been set down in the last 5 years, I really think what you'll be doing for the world needs to become into the equation. You can't change the world without changing the balance of class forces within each nation state. That is where politics are located. That is where bourgeois society is located. It's located within the framework of nation states, no matter how global it gets. The American state, as Sam Gindin and I tried to show in The Making of Global Capitalism, through becoming an informal empire in the second half of the 20th century, was the key state involved in the making of global capitalism. If the American left is going to be able to shift the balance of class forces in the United States, that will have a knock-on effect on class struggles everywhere else in the world. And it'll create space for class struggles everywhere else in the world. We will then have to learn to cooperate with one another, beginning with cooperation around joint capital controls, so that capital that tries to escape one country where there's a powerful left is not allowed to take that capital into another country to escape those capital controls. Those are the type of immediate arrangements we'll need. But we'll also need to inspire one another in all kinds of ways.
And that's it. It's like being able to be a part of a movement means being able to inspire people, right? So seeing things that are happening with our comrades in other countries that are truly inspiring. For example, you know, Lula being able to, and the movement around Lula being able to maintain power after, you know, a concerted effort by the United States, the legal system and capital in Brazil to squash that, right? Being able to look at a lot of things, you know, that are happening globally, and like being able to inspire people, being able to recognize that we're in this kind of global struggle together. And also, just last thing I'll say on this is like also getting a little bit more comfortable, I think, being earnest with one another and being honest. What I mean by that is like there's an affect that I think is pretty dominant amongst the left of sort of a detachment from these things. I'm not detached from this shit at all, right? This is a struggle for dignity and a better life for people, and I care about it a lot. That's why I do this. And I think a lot of people out there feel the same way. But this kind of act that we have to sort of be resigned, you know, it's defensive, right? It's like, because you don't want to feel disappointed as we're going to go in later and talk about some bad news that's happening. You can't fall into that trap, because it prevents you from being able to hold things in the moral weight that they have. And it also does this perverse thing of sort of creating everything as equal, right? And there are things that are worse than others. There are threats that are worse than others. And we should also be able to recognize that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of a tweet by at Bagel Meme Cheese on Twitter. Twitter Maoist posting 500 tweet threads calling Cuba revisionist or a bourgeois state or whatever idiot label they've concocted in the midst of a renewed mass struggle to get Cuba removed from the U.S. list of countries that support terrorism is the dumbest thing I've seen in a bit. And like that's what we're talking about.
I think so. Basically. Well, anyways, folks, hope you guys enjoyed the sermon. We are going to go to Alex Burnell to talk about the Death Star bill in Texas, what it is, and most importantly, what we can do to get out of it. And just, you know, up front, I mean, even if, you know, Texas is something, a place that's far off from your head, I think the political strategy that's sort of laid out here, I think is really important, because it's actually putting meat on the kind of claim that people on the left make a lot of times, that we have to think broader than solely electoral politics. It's like, okay, fine, well, what do we sort of mean by that? And we are able to get into that a little bit in this interview. So let's jump to that. And then Matt and I will be back to give you all an update on Wisconsin. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here. Last week, our governor, Greg Abbott, signed HB 2127, which is nicknamed the Death Star Bill, which is a law that will fundamentally reshape a lot of Texas politics, particularly at the local level. It puts under threat a lot of progressive and pro-labor policies, and it is a huge overstep of the state-level GOP to local and more Democratic-controlled parts of the state. We're going to talk a little bit about what it means and hopefully what we can start to think about, how we can do something about it. But before we get into that, I should introduce our guest this evening. Alex Burnell goes by he, him, is from the great city of San Antonio, is a DSA member and an organizer. Alex, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here, David. Thanks for inviting me to talk about this important bill.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things that you hate to be right. You know, I've been worried about this for a little while. I think a lot of people might have gotten like a certain flavor of what is in this bill, but could you give people kind of brief understanding of what HB 2127 is and why people who, you know, support labor and local democracy should be worried?
Yeah, so to start, it's a preemption bill. And if you don't know what preemption is, it's basically a bill that would remove jurisdiction from cities and local governments to pass all kinds of policy and move it up to the state, basically saying this is only in the state's purview. This is no longer something that local leaders or organizers through ballot initiatives, local organizing can drive forward at the city level. And so it's actually losing a lot of legislative power when it comes to Texas cities and our local communities. And so we recognize it as a risk, right? So it is a preemption bill, but it's also been noted as a super preemption bill. And by super preemption, people mean to say that it actually talks about a lot of aspects of state code all at once. So if your legislation or your local ordinance touches an aspect of state code per HB 2127, you know, that ordinance might be considered illegal. These things will obviously have to be litigated over, but just the scope of the bill, the magnitude of the thing is really monstrous for local communities in terms of the kinds of things that they might want to enact at the grassroots level, or that progressive elected officials alongside those movements might want to enact on behalf of their constituents.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, just like zooming out a little bit, like, you know, local governments passing particularly like in labor, like local ordinances is just a very typical thing to do. If you think about it, the conditions in a city are oftentimes different than other parts of a state. You know, so this is not something like the way they're framing it is as if like this is some world historic overreach or overstep by cities and counties in the state of Texas. But again, it's just basic kind of governance. And really what it is it's a way to roll back a lot of pro-labor and progressive policies in the state. I want to just like, I know this has been like what a lot of people have focused on, and I think it's important actually, because it really does hit at how dangerous this is. People have been talking about what this means for workers, particularly in the heat. On this program, we've had Gus Bova on Left Reckoning before to talk about some of the brutal conditions that workers have been facing at the Tesla facilities here. Texas leads the country in deaths from heat exhaustion. And one of the things that this would certainly attack would be water break provisions for workers in general, but most notably construction workers. As you know, but just reminding our audience out here, I mean, we're in the middle of a pretty brutal heat wave. I think it's going to climb up to about 107 degrees here in Austin. Mm-hmm. And this would prevent, you know, very moderate things like a 10-minute water break every 4 hours for workers. I mean, it's very, very serious stuff that they're talking about rolling back.
Yeah, absolutely. The preemption bill, you know, puts all kinds of folks at risk for all kinds of reasons, whether it's, like you said, rolling back water breaks in a state that's notorious for already poor labor conditions because, you know, not a lot of folks are unionized. Certainly mm-hmm. the legislature doesn't have working folks' best interest in mind, but also just the conditions of that labor because of the weather, right? Because of the extreme summer heat. But, you know, we also have a worry about the future of, you know, payday lending regulation, pesticide regulation, things like plastic bag bans that, you know, used to be introduced in places like Austin and Laredo, right? Mm-hmm. Bans on fracking. These are all things that have seen preemption. And so we know how this works. And just the fact that, again, this bill has such a broad reach, it really eliminates a lot of policy options at the local level. And I think, you know, the big question here is, you know, who are the local folks at the city level that are going to the legislature and lobbying on behalf of this bill, like your local chambers of commerce, mm-hmm. your local business associations, whether it's your manufacturers associations, your temp agencies, you know, those kind of lobbies are going up to the state level and saying, you know, we agree with this bill. And in between them are movements on the ground at the city level and legislators that have responsibilities to their constituents, including, you know, those construction workers that you mentioned who are going to, you know, suffer unsafe working conditions as a result of this bill.
Yeah, I mean, in a second, I might want you to help me sort of outline some of the other things that are, you know, might happen from this bill that haven't got as much coverage. But, you know, on Left Reckoning, we're fair. We're fair-minded. We're fair and balanced. So, you know, let's let the right wing respond a little bit because they have to sell this bill to people. Not well, but they have to in some way or another. This is Texas State Representative Dustin Burrows, who's the author of HB 2127 on the Texas Public Policy Foundation's talk show, I guess. He's being interviewed by James Quintero. This is what he says. I'd just like to get you to respond to this a little bit, Alex, about what this will mean in terms of benefits for working and average Texans. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a great bill. Can you tell us, if this bill were to pass in a law, how do you think the average Texan would benefit?
So, you know, this is the type of bill, reason I ran for office. A deep belief in, you know, capitalism that has done more to provide jobs and food and economy and economic growth and opportunity for people than any other form, you know, of government out there, any other form of market structure. And with this, what we do is we get government ordinances out of the way so small businesses can grow, can thrive. It's going to attract business and capital to Texas because we'll be a pro-business state. And what does that mean? That means higher wages, you know, more jobs, better, you know, competition for those type of things. And so as we're dealing with rampant inflation and all the other problems, this is actual good, sound economic policy that every Texan is going to benefit from.
So is this good, solid economic policy that's going to benefit average and everyday Texans, Alex?
Yeah. So a couple things in what he said. First of all, you know, the framing of the discussion around this legislation, folks that are proponents of it, like Dustin Burrows, folks like the Texas Public Policy Foundation, right-wing think tank here in Texas, they're arguing for regulatory consistency, that if you're a company operating in Texas, you know, and cities have different ordinances, you know, you're increasing your administrative burden to have to comply with all kinds of different rules, right? And so regulatory consistency will lead to, as they argue, a better business climate. And he says, you know, better wages, better jobs, et cetera. But, right, I think it's important to know, you know, what has it meant that the auto industry has moved gradually from the north to the south, right? Mm-hmm. In places like San Antonio, there's a Toyota plant. That's not because we have great wages as a result of, you know, being an attractive business environment. It's obviously because we have a low minimum wage at the state level. And so they're arguing for regulatory consistency. And so what I would just ask people to consider is, what has that consistency meant? It's meant that the state has all the policy making power as cities have more and more responsibility, right? They have less and less power and more responsibility. And the consequences of that for everyday working people is that we have depressed wages, poor labor standards. And so he's just taking the actual outcomes of the policies that they enact and inverting the actual consequences of the policy once they're in effect.
No, 100%. I mean, like, as we've covered a lot in this program, you know, the kind of triumphalism, for example, of a lot of the companies that are moving here, particularly a company like Tesla, you know, the idea is like, oh, they're coming to Texas because Texas is leading innovation. It's like, well, no, actually, Elon Musk is running from multiple labor lawsuits in the state of California. And he thinks that the government and Texans in general, I'll say that Musk thinks that Texans are chumps and he can come here and take advantage of working people. You know, so it's a race to the bottom kind of argument here. Mm-hmm. And as we said before, you know, this kind of Texas is not, you have to make a pretty incredible argument to say that Texas is an overregulated state at this point. You know, we do have some funny, you know, arcane laws, but that just is because our government barely meets every, you know, couple of years. You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the progressives and the strategy in just a second, Alex. But, you know, when we talked a couple of days ago about this, you noted there's a couple other things that are likely to come out of this bill that are in this bill that a lot of people might not be as familiar with. So is there anything that you've sort of seen that you don't think has been sort of covered or talked about enough when it comes to HB 2127?
Yeah. So if you look at the text of the legislation, a lot of the news reporting that's been done about the bill is obviously about the super preemption, the preemption aspects of this bill, things that, you know, cities and local governments won't be able to do if the policies that they bring forward touch any aspect of state code, right? And that's basically moving policymaking power, policymaking jurisdiction up to the state level and away from cities. That's been well told. And all the consequences, you know, we've already discussed a little bit in this conversation, but some other aspects of the bill that I think are just as vital to understand because they change the ways that progressives, leftists, people in the city, at the city level, interested in bettering things for working people. We also have to understand what else this bill does to make that harder. And to start that, right, first, there's some change of venue provisions. If you're not familiar with change of venue, it basically means that litigation over this bill can start in places other than, right, where the claim's actually being fought over, right? And so originally this bill said anybody in the state can sue anybody else in the state, any other city or local policymaker, if they feel that, you know, if that policy were to spread, that it would, you know, in some way harm them, right? Maybe jeopardize their bottom line, maybe lead to something that a service that they provide being illegal, a product that they use being illegal, like a pesticide. Then the committee substituted the bill because people cried foul that, you know, that would basically gum up the legal system and there would be a lot of legal noise as a result of it. So they changed the language of the bill to say, you know, you can change the venue of these lawsuits to contiguous counties. That means counties that touch one another, right? But if you look at a map of Texas politically in terms of red and blue, right, all the blue is touched by red with the exception of the valley. And so you have a situation where people can be sued in places where justices and judges are chosen in a partisan way. So you can be sued in a very hostile court in a neighboring red court from a blue county. So that's the change of provision piece. The other element of this bill that I think is worth kind of pulling out and giving more attention is the fact that it gets rid of qualified immunity. And that is, you know, in terms of a party in a lawsuit, right, qualified immunity means that for individual city council members, they would be shielded from being sued and it would be the city, right, the actual city entering the lawsuit as opposed to an individual council member. Getting rid of qualified immunity means that council members can be sued personally. And so we need to see this as a chilling effect on, you know, progressive city council members that might stick their neck out and support you know, what movements are doing on the ground, because they have that organizer from the dais mentality about their role as an elected official is really to work, you know, with organizations on the ground, their constituents who are doing small D local grassroots democracy work on behalf of, you know, all the residents in their community to try to improve something with a local ordinance. You know, if that council member feels that there's even a potential that they might be sued personally, it's going to make those kinds of appeals a lot more challenging. And not only that, but combined with the change of venue, you know, they might be sued in a hostile court. And so this really changes the terrain that Texas organizers sort of have to work under as we continue to face different aspects of minority rule, which I hope we are able to get into and talk about.
Yeah, no, we definitely will. I mean, but, you know, I think that this is just like a really important point. And to also remember this in relationship to some of the other things, like, you know, Abbott now is going to start coming after district attorneys that he doesn't like. And, you know, there's an irony here. And I know there's only so much that you could point out Republican hypocrisy on these things. But when Ken Paxton right now is like under impeachment and under investigation for serious corruption and crimes, one of the arguments that you get from the Republican, his Republican defenders is, well, Ken Paxton was elected and he's been elected multiple times. Therefore, you know, the court of public opinion, you know, the court of democracy is like the final court, the final say. And yet that's basically being denied to millions of Texans, both with their district attorneys, if Greg Abbott doesn't like them, frankly, or in this case, literally threatening them with, you know, lawsuits, which could be absolutely devastating. Not that, you know, it's the focus of this, you know, city council members, you don't make a lot of money doing that, right? So getting yourself like personally responsible, you know, to some kind of rogue lawsuit, it can be really, really damaging for any kind of individual. I mean, this is a direct threat to democracy, both in the ability to legislate, but also just in the ability of the right to be able to attack people on an individual level that I think is really dangerous and important to point out. But I wanted to sort of talk about strategy and, you know, the progressive movement and labor movement in Texas in response to this, because I'm going to play this other clip of Burroughs that I think is really astute on his point, on his part, because it sort of lays out the threat and probably what will be the reality for some members. But also just for people who aren't in Texas, have been following Texas politics, you know, while it seems at the moment that there's a lot of difficulty in winning these kind of larger state level elections, right, talking about governor and things like that, there's been a tremendous grassroots movement to get things done at the local level, to do things like ballot initiatives so that people can have their opinions represented, can have the wants and desires of the community represented. And the Republican Party seriously sees this as a threat to their power, because if you can have a good example of what a different kind of politics can deliver, then, you know, the kind of more culture war fantasy politics that the Republican Party needs to get elected, you know, it becomes less appealing when, like, oh man, you know, these people in these other cities are getting paid more than me or not dying at work. But here's Dustin Burroughs talking about what he thinks the response is going to be like from cities. And I want to hear you respond to that. Then we can sort of talk about maybe how we can push back against this.
See it already. Texas's big city mayors, who of course are progressives, are going to hoot and holler about local control. How do you intend to respond to that criticism?
Well, two things. I mean, we're now dealing with, you know, issues they have never historically dealt with in the past. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10 years ago, the idea that cities were going to have Green New Deal legislation or pro-labor legislation was unheard of and unthinkable. But, you know, we've started to see, you know, this beginning, you know, small, and it just keeps growing and growing. So this is not about, you know, this local control idea. It's about right size and where it actually belongs. It's really kind of a stay in your lane bill, which says if you run for, you know, city council or becoming a mayor, you know, work on the roads, work on the streets, work on the things that you ran to do, and you don't have to get mixed up in this. And privately, I think a lot of these mayors and councilmen are going to be relieved, because now when these progressive activists and people with their agendas come to them, they can say, no, we cannot even talk about that because you need to go to the state capitol where this debate rightfully belongs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so there's two things there. And I think we've sort of talked enough about the, unless you had anything else you want to add about like the local control and that aspect of it. But, you know, as I was just sort of laying out, like there has been a lot of success recently with progressive and labor movements in this state, sort of, you know, and sometimes having like allies in government, right? But a lot of times also sort of pressuring elected officials in these cities to start standing up and doing more for people? I mean, you know, how chilling do you think that this could be? You know, what kind of hurdles does this put to that kind of progressive strategy that, you know, has sort of been the focus of the movement here for the past few years?
Sure. So there's a lot of what I want to say on this particular question and on this particular topic. You know, first, I think it really depends on the point about how this will be received by council members. We should have no illusions that just because the, you know, cities are where most people live, that the cities are tend to be the places that in Texas, you know, go for Bernie and go for Biden, you know, clear progressive bastions, and otherwise, you know, at least if you look at a political map, you know, tend to vote red, tend to vote conservative. That it doesn't mean that that automatically gives you, you know, a full slate of progressive council members. You definitely have council members who are there to do the bidding of their local, you know, capitalist class, right? Your arms of that capitalist class, your chambers of commerce, those kinds of folks. And so there are going to be folks in the room that look at a bill like HB 2127 as a positive because, you know, it removes any responsibility for them to do anything but what they like, which is, you know, sort of serve as mouthpieces in those seats for those institutions, right? And so there are going to be council members that really enjoy that, you know, this sort of conflict that it creates for them politically is now dealt with. But for, you know, folks that recognize the particular position that cities have in macroeconomics, right? Not just, you know, thinking about it in the way that some of the articles have discussed HB 2127, you know, this kind of local control versus regulatory consistency, but really thinking about, you know, every time the GDP of Texas is touted, you know, all those things that are discussed as positives of Texas by leadership for really cynical reasons, right? Not including, you know, all the labor and all the effort of Texas's working class, oftentimes, you know, in those segregated communities in those cities, right? For those folks in particular, right? We've got to talk about the role of cities in helping that macroeconomic picture be true, right? Where Texas is a large economy. So I think this gives cities particular leverage, right? In the fight against sort of capital accumulation and increasing state control over an ever-increasing number of policy areas, right? We've talked a lot about power grabs by the state level, but I think, you know, cities are in a particular place where they have leverage, and their local city council members are in a place where they have a lot of responsibility too, right? They, Jesse Jackson used to say, cities have more and more responsibility and less power. And what he's talking about is population, that literally people, you know, in terms of kind of demography, sociology, live in cities. And so that's what gives cities this unique leverage. And I think there's places where, you know, that's been the paradigm of politics. If we look, you know, at the left in Europe, at the left in Latin America, the city is a key place, a key site of struggle. You get left-wing mayors that talk about the role of urban housing in overall capital accumulation for the entire macroeconomic system, right? And you talk about the kind of labor contributions of people working in an urban core. This is what gives cities a unique position vis-a-vis the state. Every time the state touts the size of its economy, the response should be who creates that wealth, right? In a lot of ways, the Texas cities that are under attack because of this bill should have a lot of coordinated pushback. And so to get to the second part of your strategy, you know, what are some ways out of the impasse, right? What are some ways to basically stop this pitch fight, or at least get back into a fighting position about this piece of legislation? I think a couple things. Number one, and I think the Texas AFL-CIO said this well, right, that if local elected officials lose their legislative power, one thing that we can do is fight for the kinds of things that we would want to receive in ordinances inside of union contracts, right? And there's, you know, several historical episodes where the sort of like lifespan of a policy going from the very local, smallest level inside of a contract, you know, up to federal law has been well charted. Sarah Nelson likes to tell the story about how the AFA and CWA first fought for domestic partnership, domestic benefits, and that it was a early episode of fighting for LGBTQ rights at the bargaining table. So if Texas cities are going to lose a lot of kind of legislative power as a result of this preemption bill, organized workers should try to fight for these things at the bargaining table. And the benefit of doing so, right, is that it builds a labor movement, which if we continue to build the labor movement and we can get it working in a coordinated way across cities, this kind of structural point about the role of cities in capital accumulation and the role that cities have played for left politics elsewhere in the world can be more true for Texas. So first thing is negotiate for those things in your contract. That has the, you know, the additional benefit of organizing, you know, more labor unions as a whole, right? Organized labor will be a key and necessary aspect of pushing back on this bill. The other thing is, you know, cities have city attorneys, and a lot of this legislation, because it's so broad, is going to be determined in test cases, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be determined in courts, you know, which is why there's all those other provisions that we talked about, change of venue, qualified immunity. We don't know exactly how this is going to land on the policymaking power of cities. We know it's a big threat, but ultimately, in specific application, it's going to be tested in court, which means city attorneys are going to have to go to bat over, you know, what the ramification of this law is for local lawmakers' legislative power. And so if we have activist city attorneys, as we've seen in other instances, in even recent Texas history, like around Senate Bill 4, the Texas Show Me Your Papers bill, or coordinated activity around mask mandates in school, or coordinated activity like to fight for paid sick law, right? It shows that cities can engage in a sort of united front, a collective effort. And I think, you know, ensuring that council members sort of know that litigation is going to be a key plank in how this plays out, empowering their attorneys to make arguments rather than to just sort of like call balls and strikes before ordinances even get enacted, as city attorneys often do, you know, behave in a conservative way. And if they can make appeals to their constituents that, you know, because litigation is a key tactic here, you know, and litigation's expensive, you know, if they're out there making the arguments that like, look, we allow ourselves to spend money every time we have to go into a lawsuit with the police over an episode of police brutality, we should also be willing to spend legal money to defend the rights of cities to legislate on behalf of their constituents. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a price tag concern here that, you know, local leaders don't feel like they can defend expensive litigation in front of their constituents, right? But I think if you can make the appeal to constituents that this is part of ensuring that, you know, cities retain their power in an increasingly radicalized state leadership, I think there's a lot of kind of broad appeal that doesn't just have to do with a niche activist left, but can resonate with folks that realize, you know, when the state's in control, they try to overturn our elections. When the state's in control, they put, you know, bounty hunters chasing folks trying to receive life-saving abortion care, right? Mm-hmm. But the state is a hostile actor. And if we don't fight, right, either in the courts or by building the labor movement, it will get worse. And I think that that has broad appeal, right? So also, you know, empowering local attorneys to be activists, right, or city attorneys to be activists, and then linking up that activity. And then the same thing with the labor movement, right? If we're fighting for these things in contracts and the local labor movement is linking up with other CLCs, right? This is the way that we present the united front. The final thing that I would say, just to put a round point on it, is again, that city point, that I think cities are in a particular place and actually referencing elsewhere in the world is helpful and clarifying in this way, right? Guys like David Harvey, who listeners of this show are probably pretty familiar with, right, writes a book, Rebel Cities, for a reason, right? He's arguing that cities are a particular nexus for the macroeconomy, for capital accumulation. That's true for Texas, and that's true for Texas cities. We fit a pattern of the rest of the world, right? And that's what gives us structural leverage to sort of push back in a particular way if we're willing to adopt a different set of tactics and a completely different relationship to the way that this law has been framed. The way the law has been framed so far is, you know, local control versus regulatory consistency. Instead, you know, instead of, you know, progressives left fighting for local control, instead of the right characterizing it as regulatory consistency, I would rather put it as, you know, majorities versus minority rule, right? Most people in Texas live in cities. You know, we obviously want to legislate over things that we think impact our local communities and have done so numerous times over the years. So this is majorities of Texans speaking back about the kind of governance that they want and running into a crisis of democracy because their local elected officials are disempowered. And then they look at the state level and it's, you know, gerrymandered unbelievably so that, you know, districts are not competitive. Republicans control most of the legislative committees. And so a lot of legislation stops at committee and doesn't move further to floor debate. The governor has the veto. And then the court system, in a lot of instances, you know, especially at the Supreme Court level, is all Republican. And so I think you've got multiple examples of minority rule in terms of the state leadership in the state. And you've got majorities on the ground really representing that you know, new generations of Texans that have these kind of policy priorities. And so I think recharacterizing this bill as the majority against the minorities, you know, going to get us closer to that position where we see, again, cities in a particular role vis-a-vis the state government. And then you layer in the strategy, build your labor movement, fight for these things in contracts, and then get your city attorneys lined up for a fight, right? I think that's the way we actually get to a position where we don't feel so fatalistic because of this legislation.
Yeah, and I mean, like, two things. Like, one particular to Texas, I think it's important for Texan, like, leftist, progressive, socialists to be confident. If you look at, for example, just like on the major hot button issues, the legislation that we get in the state is way out of step with even public opinion on things like abortion. Hell, even guns is a lot closer than I think people recognize sometimes. And recognizing that the Republican Party not only sort of represents like you know, maybe a right wing or reactionary view, but even within their own base, like a minority position a lot of times, even with their voters, and like having some confidence to be able to stand on your own 2 feet and say that is important. But the second thing, the reason I think this strategy is a really important way to frame and think about this is it really reintroduces into politics things like class power. So like when you're talking about the cities being like economic engines, what we're talking about here is not so much, you know, the big corporations, but actually like the labor and the people who produce and create, and being able to recognize that like you have tremendous power. And I know sometimes it feels, you know, difficult to recognize that because labor has been so weak in the country and in the state generally. But, you know, when it comes to something like this, that the only way that things will change is with a more radical, militant labor movement with more commitment to organizing. It puts things, something in American politics that is usually outside of politics into play. And what I mean by that is like labor and work, right? In American democracy, questions of the economy, questions of labor usually are sort of outside, right? That's mm-hmm. governed by the market. And this way of thinking about it really brings that to the center. And it's something that I think is going to be really important for us to be building those kind of movements we all want to see. And, you know, when you're in a moment and you're lining up on one side and other people are lining up on the other, things get edified really quickly. Mm-hmm. And like, this has a lot of potential, I think, to sort of break through some of the hurdles and blocks that we've had with building progressive or pro-worker policy in the state for a while. Alex, I really appreciate you coming on. I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to add? I know hopefully there'll be more on this coming soon for people, you know, to check out, and we'll certainly be covering it. But is there anything else that you'd want the listeners to know about this?
Yeah, just a couple things. First, you know, there is, as I just laid out, some options, right? Mm-hmm. There's different ways to relate to this bill that go from the local, that, you know, this is an attack on ordinances, local policymaking, to the global, right? The city mm-hmm. has a particular place in the overall process of capital accumulation. And like David just said, that's leverage. And so that's where to start thinking about how we deal with this law. And then, you know, what do we need to rebuild? And what do we need to do in terms of coordination, right? More militant labor movement for sure, fighting for these things in contracts for sure, lining up our city attorneys and trying to do litigation across cities, right? Mm-hmm. Incredibly valuable. The second thing I'd say, and this is just to Dustin Burroughs' comment about, you know, there not being any tradition of kind of local organizing, you know, that this is all brand new, that the Green New Deal stuff has really led to activist city government or whatever it is he intended to say. You know, Emmett Tanayuka, it's standing on the steps of San Antonio City Hall and organized a pecan sheller strike in the 30s. And that was at the city level, right? Understanding, you know, the industrial economy relies on cities, right, at that time, right? And so there is a tradition of local organizing. You could run through every city and give a strong tradition of local organizing. So he's wrong on the facts. He's trying to tell you a story that's convenient to his point. And then, you know, finally, if you want to start relating to politics this way, thinking about politics this way, you know, pay attention to what goes on this summer. I'm wearing a Teamsters TDU Ready to Strike t-shirt where, you know, a lot of the same issues that we talked about with workers dealing with unbearable heat are going to be on display as the contract gets ready to expire and TDU members are out there as the sort of left end of the Teamsters, you know, getting ready to strike. And so, you know, those are the kinds of forms, those are the kinds of politics that I think are also going to be incredibly relevant to House Bill 2127, that a frame like local control versus regulatory consistency is just like, you know, that's speaking about it as public policy, but speaking about it in terms of strategy, you know, we're the majority. They're the minority, and they recognize that this is a way that we've gotten things done. And so they're working to close that door. The sooner that we recognize that it's a tit for tat in Texas, and like Gerald Horn, recognize that, you know, we're the canary in the coal mine for U.S. fascism, and we got a particular role to play in saving the country by figuring out these bills, by leaning into to the tradition of the South as being a place where really radical organizing happens, I think the better suited will be to deal with laws like this, and it won't feel so fatalistic. It won't feel like, you know, the Death Star is going to blow up all the planets. In the end, you know, the rebels do destroy the Death Star. So that's what I'm saying we need to do.
Well, hell yeah, brother. Well, Alex, I really appreciate you coming on Left Reckoning this evening. There'll be links below for people to follow Alex, and I appreciate all of your work. And yeah, brother, thanks so much.
Good job, David. That was a very good good interview.
Well, thank you so much, Matt.
on the Death Star bill.
You know, I have to take a little second here. It was so funny because I believe the Texas AFL-CIO started calling it that. And then, of course, like we covered it a little bit. I was coming through it was coming down the pipe here on Left Reckoning. But I think a lot of people, you know, were surprised, or, you know, they heard about it for the first time when it happened. And it was so funny. I was just sort of like perusing the comments and the reactions to people when they're saying, they're like, why the hell would they call this the Death Star bill? Like the Republicans, right? Don't they realize that those are the bad guys? You know, that's such a great, in terms of like, yes, I guess it is disinformation in a certain way, but that's such a great branding thing. When people like actually think, oh, the Republicans are calling it this, right? And that's just how evil they are. Like, whatever, if it builds some agitation, it's good.
Right. Like, you wonder, like, is that sort of slice of the electorate equal to our hyper aware slice of the electorate?
Like, exactly.
And like, basically, like people that are like pollsters or like political propagandists, like, yeah, we're just going to go after those people and not really deal with y'all.
yeah, but I mean, look, you know, to the credit of the Republicans, some of them did start to run with it. They're like, oh, they're so scared of this, they're calling it the Death Star bill, right? So, you know, they took it.
Look, if I'm a Republican, I'm like, damn, I want to be on that ship. Probably got, yeah, you know, I haven't seen Star Wars, but I mean, I imagine probably some of the best, you know,
the best guys are on that one. I mean, it's as big as the best.
Yeah, the best intergalactic real estate. You probably got the biggest, highest ceilings, I imagine, living on the Death Star. I don't know.
Dude, but, you know, just like really fast too. I mean, like, it's hot as hell here right now. Mm. And like the idea of pulling or blocking in San Antonio, they're trying to pass a water break requirement. Other cities have them. You know, again, like the water break requirements that are on the books in places, you know, are like water and shade for 10 minutes every 4 hours. You know, talking about regulatory burden, basically. I mean, it's inhumane conditions that they're sort of saying it's like too difficult for them to keep up with.
And then some people want to be like, well, on the other hand, maybe delivery drivers shouldn't use air conditioning because of the climate.
Exactly. Okay, I'm even being a good person. I mean, I'm dying right now because I've cranked my, I've turned my AC off because we're running, our grid's faltering right now. I don't think it's going to go under, but there's a capacity problem right now. So I'm doing my part, but, you know, I'm just talking into a microphone right now. I'm uncomfortable, let alone working outside.
Well, you risk being one of the, like, Boris Johnson type flirting the measures. You're doing it right in public, because what if, like, somebody did, like, a close look at your background and they see your, like, flag flitter a little bit and it's like, his air conditioning.
I have a fan on.
Let's talk to some, let's do our new segment, Depressing the Turnout. Tony Evers, governor of Wisconsin, recently, well, let's look at this. Let's do it this way. Imagine you're a voter. Well, actually, let's even back up. Look at a different state, Minnesota, stay close to my heart. We recently did a segment on basically what is kind of like the best case scenario you could expect from giving a, Democrats. To be fair, this is a trifecta, so Democrats have a full thing there, and actually got as much as you could expect, which is like a lot of good things done, like feeding kids and some labor protections, and then the one of the crowning achievements being undercut by the governor after Capitol threatens a strike for 20 minutes.
Wait, blocking the way you didn't say what it blocking, was. Blocking, yeah, the
gig worker bill, to be specific with that. You know, it was a big victory. People dancing, including the activists, again, the people really that need to be there to make this party do things. Celebrating that victory only for governor to take a phone call from Uber saying, actually, we need to look at this a little bit closer. Let's imagine that you are a voter in Wisconsin last year, and you are concerned about public schools. Scott Walker did a number on higher education, particularly there, and collective bargaining of teachers. And so you would be excited to have a champion on the Democratic side who was a teacher himself. And also here is, if you search Michaels, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, versus Evers on schools, here's what you would get to inform yourself.
Part of Tim Michaels' plan is to allow any student in the state to qualify for the voucher. It uses taxpayer money to pay for kids to go to private schools. Democratic Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill to get rid of the voucher's current income limits.
They're worried that it's taking money away from the public schools. They say it's a new entitlement program. What do you say to those critics of the school voucher program?
I say if you're at a public school, you're an administrator there, and you think that you're doing a great job, you have nothing to worry about. But if you're failing, like a lot of schools are in MPS, then you should be concerned. Why? Because parents are going to find other options, and they deserve to have the opportunity to find other options.
Evers has spent recent weeks welcoming kids back to public.
For folks just listening, that was the Republican opponent.
When I came to office, we worked at trying to fix a decade of underinvestments in our schools. Now our K through 12 schools ranked 8th best in the nation after ranking 17th just 5 years ago.
That's according to U.S. News and World Report. The Democratic governor urges the Republican-controlled legislature to spend $2 billion more on public schools. He wants to use part of the state's estimated $5 billion budget surplus.
Over the past decade, Republicans have cut more than $4 billion from education budgets that I propose as governor and as state superintendent, and that's a billion with a B. So we have a lot of work to do to fully fund our schools and do it the right way.
Republican legislative leaders like Speaker Voss are already shooting down the governor's latest proposal. They often...
Your impression might be that this guy is going to stand up for education and maybe, we have a surplus in this state and we have a lack, a want of funds in public education. Let's maybe finally deliver that once we get in office. new article this morning from In These Times. Oh, here's the share screen thing. And I'll be honest, I sort of regret not covering this earlier. That's not the right one. The Evers won by about 90,000 votes, just to be specific here, or just to be precise about that election, who won that. And my Canva is here. Oh, sorry. Full screen that again, and then, all right, there it is. So this morning, Tony Evers just signed off on the largest voucher school expansion in 30 years. Public school advocates say they feel betrayed by Wisconsin's education governor and the budget package that was on his desk, a bad deal. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's bullshit in politics, but you can really tell a lot about a country's by its budget. Deal Evers, a Democrat, supported as a package of bills that were signed along with the state budget, which could increase private school voucher enrollment by 40% statewide. It could have, there's about 50,000, I believe, elsewhere in this article now. It could effectively be such a strong push towards privatization that it would put the state public schools in crisis. Evers, meanwhile, previously called the overhaul package a win for Wisconsin. Since the deal was first announced, Republicans proposed more cuts, slashing millions going to childcare programs and jeopardizing public transit. They're also eyeing cuts to the University of Wisconsin. This is all happening while the state is sitting on nearly $7 billion in a budget surplus. Evers, the former state superintendent of public instruction, campaigned as the education governor and pledged to champion Wisconsin's public schools that haven't seen a significant per pupil increase in years. Evers' initial budget proposal included $2.6 billion for K-12 schools, but the new agreement proposes $1 billion, 60% less. It's a pittance to public schools, says State Senator Chris Larson, who is also the Senate Minority Caucus chair. While Evers announced public schools will receive a $325 per pupil increase, voucher schools, charter schools, are set to receive $1,000 to $3,000 per student and could allow for $20,000 additional publicly funded seats at private schools. And there's a quote there, another from Larson. MTA leaders say the $325 promised increase isn't even accurate and issued a press release noting that the rough estimates that MPS administration has shared with the MTEA are less than $1 million new dollars in the 2003-2024 school year, which works out to be about $12 per student. And in 2024-2025, the funding is only about $2.4 million, which amounts to $38 per student. Larson said this kind of cash infusion to voucher schools is particularly troubling because they're unaccountable. And this is a key point about, I guess, some people need church on charter schools, are unaccountable to the public. Unlike public schools, which have to make finances publicly available, including employee salaries, they don't have to report any of it. According to the investigative reporting outlet Wisconsin Watch, there are currently 52,000 students using vouchers statewide. 95% of the schools they attend are religious, and the state spent $443 million on choice programs in 2022-23. Furthermore, students at voucher schools are not protected from discrimination, whether for disabilities or LGBTQ plus trans students have been especially targeted. And shout out to David Eppelsheimer here, who had been trying to get me to cover this. And I regret that, maybe distracted by primary bullshit and not on the ball here, but there's no difference than what would have got, quote, school teacher David Eppelsheimer. This is no different than what we would have gotten from Scott Walker, who worked hard to reelect Evers in 2022, pounding the pavement and serving as a canvas captain for the MTEA. I went out just about every weekend from August to November for the election, Eppelsheimer says. Now Evers is suddenly pumping tons of money into these voucher schools that are kicking out students because of their disability and their identity. So, not great.
No.
And, like, you've mentioned, like, fucking Texas has been trying to do this and failing. And
yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk too fast on it just because it's not over. Right. I'm sure there'll be a special session, but yes, for this to happen under Democratic Party rule, there is something, right? Because even
with the education guy
issues, yeah,
because you know what, like, elections should have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually cool with them having consequences.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly wicked. And, like, you know, we know the arguments against, these voucher programs, you know, they're twofold, right? It's defunding public education, while subsidizing private education for the wealthy. But it's also an opportunity for private corporations to get their hands on not just a social good, but a pool of social money, right? Because we've decided rightfully as a society that is a social good to have people, you know, educated. And like, look, like you can just make the argument here, like cynically, without like, you know, holding on to some of the nicer ideals that you should probably have. You should want to live in a society where people can read, where people can reason, where people can do math and have basic science and history education, right? Because it's better for your life to not be, you know, around ignorant people, right? That's just like the cynical, selfish argument for why we should be paying for schools for any of those people. It's like, well, I don't have a kid, right? That, you know, why should I have to pay for a school? Well, the argument is like, you want to be in a society where people are educated on some level, hopefully well. And yeah, the, you know, the other aspect is like, this is a great opportunity for private money to get in, as they were saying in that article, like they don't have to report all of these things. And you know what happens when, for example, a public school can do something efficiently? It means there's more money in the budget to do other things. What happens in these private voucher schools, right? Money is skim off the top. You know, it's a big money maker for people.
Yeah. Oh, we got an extra $3,000. Let's give it to PragerU for some coloring books. Yeah.
And, you know, one thing I will say without like jumping into all of these other discourses, but, you know, there's been this kind of constant fight that's, you know, just the new iteration of like, you know, if you don't, for example, vote for the Democratic Party, you know, for president or something like that, then like these are all the bad things that can happen. And there's been this kind of hyperfixation on Minnesota recently because they've done a lot. And I think it's an important point to note that, like, we've covered what's happened in Minnesota, right? Because a lot of it is really, you know, exciting and a victory. That doesn't come in a vacuum, right? That came because, like, society was very mobilized around certain issues and we're pushing for these things to be done, not just, like, winning an election, you know, outright. So this passive idea, right, that like, oh, if you have Democrat control of like your government, yeah, you're not going to get all the things you want, but you're going to get some good things. That ain't true. It's just not true. It could be a possibility, for example, right, as we're seeing in some aspects in Minnesota and in other aspects, disastrous when it comes to labor rights for gig workers. You know, so like this kind of passive fetish that a lot of people have about, you know, which way people vote in an election is just so erroneous. Yeah. When you see the reality, because like the everyone's just trying to find a cheat code to not have to do politics, basically. You know, it's really what a lot of that
exactly stuff is. Right. Yeah. It's like that's the bare minimum, but it's like no, like it, to see what happened in, I mean, Michigan also with the right to work thing, like the now there's a job to do, and it's not just to get back in line and vote for Evers, and like and actually like I don't even wish to make it about the fucking ballot box again yet, like it's like. Like this need some type of price needs to be exacted, whether it is like mobilizing for a different, I mean, maybe he's going to get term limit on anyway. I don't know what the situation is in Wisconsin, but like there needs to be some price. Because yeah, I don't know. Like to run on that, to say I'm the education governor, to be pictured coming out of a school bus and then to do that. To give $320 and that's if you're nice to public school things, and $1,000 to $3,000, because one thing to stress, every kid that's like, oh, I'm going to go to these charter schools, you know, Mother Teresa's, you know, school of the free market or whatever, like that is money that doesn't go to public schools.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be one thing if that if those funds stayed and it's like, okay, get those kids out of here, going to religious school, and now there's more public funds for the rest of us, but those funds are going right into those people's coffers.
No, absolutely. Well, folks, thanks for hanging out with us, Left Reckoning 123. It's not over. We're going to go to the post game. We got some fun clips and we'll be taking your calls and questions. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-940-289-7234. You know, keep those around a minute or so, but really looking forward to hearing from everybody and hanging out a little bit. You get access to that patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got a fun bonus episode to talk about nostalgia, the toy industry.
Yeah, really great, wide-ranging conversation that is ostensibly about a comic book about He-Man, but really is about sort of a century of propaganda and consent manufacturing and toys. Yeah, very interesting. Brian Bucks Brown.
And I'll be back on Thursday with the Grissom stream in the afternoon. But yeah, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Come hang out with us. We'll be on in about 10 minutes or so. See you soon.
Peace.